Yes.
Sir, before the class, I give you back the article that you gave me to copy.
Okay, thank you. He said he warned me he's going to do that. I told him that if he didn't hand back this article, I'd kill him. No, not really. No, it's just that, it happens, and it really shouldn't, but it just does, is, students come in and they want to borrow books from my private library and for reports and sometimes articles, and then they just don't come back. And many times I'm very busy when they come in and I don't make a record that stays in a permanent place, and then I look at this gap on the bookshelf and I say, what was there, first of all? And then once I figure that out, who's got it? And then I don't usually know, and then it never comes back. It gets to be rather expensive. And I haven't yet reached the point of being so gun-shy that I've stopped lending stuff, but I've been tempted. Anyway, this is an unusual article, the reason why I was so desperate to get it back. It's about incest, the number one taboo that destroys the lives of millions. And just to give you some of the highlights from the article, it says 92% of women in alcoholic recovery programs, 92%, were victims of incest. 90% of women in prisons were victims of incest. 70% of female teen drug addicts were incest victims. 75% of teen prostitutes were incest victims. I mean, it shows you that it's not just what happens at the time, but the effects just live on. And as I say, it's got a lot of graphic and information in here, and anyway, he was preparing a speech on the subject, and so I let him have that for his research. Okay. We had been talking before the break about the tension that existed, not in the sense of conflict, but you might say growing pains, you might say, that existed in the church as it expanded beyond its Jewish or even Samaritan nucleus to include Gentiles, and from the Greek-speaking world, who either were Greeks ethnically or other peoples or Romans, and that there was something that was very hard for the young church to deal with. There was a great deal of uncertainty about it. Of course, we know about the conference in Acts 15, which was the first, you might say, church council that was held, because they had to address this problem. And that many of the Jews had these hang-ups about eating freely and visiting freely with Christians who had come from a Gentile background because of their upbringing. That this is what had been normative in Palestine, is that they did not enter into a home of a Gentile, because if they did, they were ritually unclean, and they had to go through all these ritual ablutions and be separate from, certain ceremonies for a period of time, prior to being able to participate again, because they had just simply entered the home of a Gentile. Now, that's not in God's law, of course, but that was in the oral law, as expounded by the Pharisees, as a way of building a fence around the Torah, because what they were against was intermarriage with Gentiles. Well, you can't run any great risk of intermarrying with a Gentile if you never socialize with them. And if you never eat with them in their homes, and of course you don't invite them to your home, and you don't visit their homes, you can't very well get to know them too well to run the risk of getting married to somebody from that family. And so therefore they backed way, way off. Now later on, of course, because they had backed off that far, other attitudes towards Gentiles began to creep in, such as just very strong negative feelings to them as being somehow inferior as people. And this was something that was, of course, not intended, even by the Pharisaic leaders, but eventually crept in. And the apostles grew up in this kind of an environment, and whether they consciously imbibed of it or not, they did, and they were affected by it. And to the extent that we've already, I think, commented about this, is that when Peter and Barnabas were up there in Antioch, and they were fellowshipping at table with some of the Gentile Christians that were there, some of the Jewish Christians that came from Jerusalem, that were, as it says, very zealous for the law, and all, meaning not God's law, but for even the ritual laws, they felt they should still maintain those, even if they weren't required, they felt that they should not let down in that area. that they kind of pressed Peter about this, and Peter felt guilty about it and moved away to a separate table, and Barnabas did the same, and apparently some of the others did likewise, and Paul had to very mightily handle that problem. Otherwise, we could have very well had a split in the church. Indeed, the Apostle James, Christ's brother, who was the head of the Jerusalem church, after the other apostles, of course, went elsewhere, carrying out their commissions as Christ led them to do so, was always held in high regard by the Jewish community. Although they were not pleased with the Nazarenes, as they called them, overall, they tended to regard James very, very highly. In fact, he was called James the Just by the Jews. Because although it was not required that he keep the ritual items of the law, he voluntarily chose to do so and tended to urge the Jewish Christians still in Jerusalem to do so also. Even though it was not required, he says, look, nothing stops you from doing more than is required. And if it avoids giving offense and helps the witness, well, why not? You know, let's not be afraid to do it. And so even some of the religious leaders among the Jews were very, very upset when James was killed. They felt that this was a grave injustice, and they actually lived in fear of the retribution that would come on their community because a righteous man, as they looked at him, despite his acceptance of his brother as the Messiah, they regarded him as a righteous man, had been killed wrongly, and they felt that God would surely punish, you know, the whole Jewish community in Jerusalem because of it. And of course, this was very much in the spirit of what Paul himself wrote about all things are lawful to me, meaning within the bounds of God's law, but not all things are expedient. That sometimes it is more expedient not to use one's liberty and emblazon it like a red flag in front of a bull. You know, it's better to not use everything you're allowed to do just because it serves the work better. And I think all of us at some time or other have sometimes been asked to consider that principle in the way we've personally conducted our lives. But Paul was an individual who was really quite unique, because although he was a very zealous Pharisee and very knowledgeable even about the ticky-tacky points of the law, because he is not lying or even being vain when he says that, you know, he certainly is an Israelite of the Israelites and a Pharisee of the Pharisees, meaning, you know, just like what it talks about Ezra, a ready scribe in the law of Moses. This, he says, I know where it's at. I mean, I can debate just about anybody and probably not lose out on these technical points. I know what these things are. But he also grew up in a diaspora community where, although he was given a Jewish religious upbringing, since his father was a Roman citizen and a businessman, he had contacts with Gentiles as a result. And it's quite evident from certain comments that sort of work their ways in here and there in his letters or in the book of Acts that he was very knowledgeable about Greek literature and philosophy. But this was a part of his background as well. In the same way that we have attempted here at the college, for those of you who are seniors, to give you an education which extracts the best of this world's culture and arts and science, as well as, of course, as thorough a grounding in God's Word as we can possibly give you in the space of time that we have at our command. And so he was well educated in a liberal arts sense, as well as, of course, being Jewish educated. And this was a very important thing that fitted him for his mission, in that he was able to work effectively with intelligent Gentiles and well-educated Gentiles, because he shared some of their knowledge, and also because he grew up in the diaspora, because of necessity you had to have more contacts with non-Jews. He didn't have a lot of these hang-ups about Gentiles that the Palestinian apostles had. In the same way that some of us, because of where we were brought up, not because necessarily our parents inculcated these things in us, but sometimes we imbibe them from the environment of the school or the neighborhood, grew up with negative impressions being funneled into our brains, very impressionable minds, about either other religious groups or other racial groups. And that doesn't mean that we're acutely prejudiced, but we may still have some small areas there that are not ideally the way they should be. That's just a fact of the way we've brought up. And Paul, of course, was spared much of that. Now, what I want to concentrate on in the rest of this lecture is the sort of unique features of a number of these different churches that he dealt with and how that played a role in his ability to spread the gospel. Now, I hadn't started this yet, had I, last time? I didn't think I had, because I divided the material a little differently than I had done in the past. Let's pick up the story then in chapter 13 of Acts. And I admit that this may not be totally new ground to all of you, that perhaps Mr. Kelly has dealt with this in his... He teaches Acts, doesn't he? Yeah, in his class in Acts. And it's possible even that Dr. Meredith has taken some time from the homiletical and exegetical discussion of even Paul's epistles to mention some of the things I'll be bringing out. But since not everybody has taken Acts, you know, and this is the period we want to close our course with, I want to go through it. In chapter 13, we're told about how Paul was separated, according to God's will, to go and preach the gospel in other areas. And the first real place where he spoke to a large body of individuals was in Antioch, Pisidia, where we pick it up in verse 14. When they had departed from Perga, they came to Antioch in Pisidia, and actually it should really be rendered as not in Pisidia, but by Pisidia, because Antioch is not in the region of Pisidia. It's a small technical thing, but the English text is not quite correct in that. And went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and sat down. After the reading of the law and the prophets, in the synagogues in Palestine as well as in the diaspora, they had a section of the law which was read. And when did that practice begin? I feel totally deflated. Mark? Right. Is that Ezra had set in motion this cyclical reading of portions of the law so people would be constantly reminded of it. But I don't think we mentioned when this pattern of reading from the prophets began, to read a selection also cyclically from the prophets. Not that you could cover all the prophets, but, you know, they chose sections. Because during the persecution of Antiochus Epiphanes, it was specifically outlawed that the Jews could not read from the Torah. And so what they did is they looked into the prophets to find material that expressed much of the same teaching for that particular section that would normally be read, and they read that instead. Talk about sticking to the letter of the law but not breaking it. And then, of course, after the persecution of Antiochus Epiphanes, rather than just forget about these readings from the prophets, they just maintained them, reinstituted the readings from the law, and continued to read from the prophets also. And so they now still practice that even today, this reading first from the law, the assigned section, and then, of course, the assigned reading from the prophets. And usually the incident in the prophets, as I said, has as its central core the same teaching point that's in the section of the law that was read. So this was the normal service. Now, and after the main part of the service was over, I don't mean the complete service was over, but the main part of it was over, the rulers of the synagogue sent to them saying, "Men and brethren, if you have any word of exhortation for the people, say on." Because it was not uncommon for them to share news about other communities this way. It was sort of an official grapevine kind of thing. Also, if they were qualified to speak in a homiletical way because of their training, therefore, it was like having a visiting minister, you know, give a sermon, you know, kind of thing. And this was sort of a double invitation to them to use as was most fitting, you know, to give a sermon or to just give a sort of news report about the Jews and their situation in the communities where they had, through which they had passed. Now, in this verse, we find that Paul gets up and says, "Men of Israel and you who fear God, listen," or "give ear," I think it says in the old King James. He is not being redundant. But he is addressing the two groups in attendance in the synagogue. The men of Israel, of course, are Jews, who are the people who fear God. Right. Not Gentile proselytes, because then they would be men of Israel. Because once somebody becomes a full proselyte, he's a Jew. He is counted as being a full part of Israel. But the God-fearers, or the what began to be called the proselytes at the gate. In other words, those that became committed to God's laws all the way to the point of just short of formally joining the community. And they did everything but formally join the community. And for men, of course, the big obstacle was circumcision, which under the conditions of that day was neither pleasant or safe, for most individuals. And so rather than go through that, they said, well, I'll do everything else. I will observe all the points of the law that God commands, but I just won't do that. And so they were called proselytes of the gate or God-fearers. And apparently that's the sense in which Cornelius is referred to and as being a God-fearer, that he had basically embraced everything but, you know, the point of formal circumcision. And so this explains something, because you have a group of people, Gentiles, residents of the area, who have, we don't know for how long, but let's say for maybe years, attended the synagogue and have been keeping the points of the Mosaic law. You see. Therefore, they have sat in the synagogue and had the scriptures read to them, portion by portion, maybe for years. They are not an ignorant group as far as what is in the scriptures. They are familiar with the scriptures. That explains Paul's address, which is a very scripturally oriented sermon. Because he knows that not just the Jews, but also the God-fearers can understand the content of the message. Now, today, if you were to go into the synagogue and just sit and listen, and the law was read to you, it would mean nothing to you. Because you wouldn't understand it. It'd be read in Hebrew. But that wasn't the case in Paul's day in the diaspora. Because when this is the only period of time that I'm familiar with in the whole history of the Jews throughout the world that this was true. That the scriptures were read not in Hebrew, even though that was, of course, the language in which they were inspired, but they were read in Greek. Which, being Greek speaking, the Gentiles could easily understand. Because the text that was used was not the Hebrew text, but is the text that we call the Septuagint. That was the text that was read in the synagogue. As I said, that's the only period in Jewish history that I'm aware of, and it's not just the time of Jesus, the first century AD, but also goes back into the first century BC also. And even into the second century, at least the mid-second century B.C., when the Jews were really widely scattered throughout the Greek-speaking world and found it difficult to retain enough Hebrew to understand their own scriptures, and then, of course, the Septuagint was written, they preferred to use the text that they more easily understood. You might say, well, why don't they do that now? Because probably percentage-wise, fewer Jews know Hebrew well enough to understand the scriptures when it's read anyway. Of course, we have printed copies of the scriptures with English translations that people can read if they don't understand it. But even more important, in those days, the center of Jewish life was still the temple that kept the community sort of oriented together. Once the temple was destroyed, that center didn't exist. The only thing that could keep them together was the scripture in its original language. And so people had to force themselves to just stick with the Hebrew text. So anyway, these people could understand it and had been in attendance in the synagogue for years and therefore could follow the points in Paul's sermon, which we won't dwell on over long because the content is not so important to us at this point in time. Just to note the nature of his audience and the strong scriptural basis of his approach in preaching the gospel. Now, the net effect of this preaching was, as we see, verse 42, when the Jews went out of the synagogue, the Gentiles begged that these words might be preached to them on the next day of the reading of the Torah, as it should be translated, not Sabbath. Now, when the congregation had broken up, many of the Jews and devout proselytes, now these are full proselytes, not just the God-fearers, there were always some, followed Paul and Barnabas, who, speaking to them, persuaded them to continue in the grace of God. And the next day of the reading of the Torah, as it should be translated, almost the whole city came together to hear the word of God. And this says something. The people that were either full proselytes from the local community or were proselytes at the gate were well-connected, influential people, because through them the word rapidly spread through the all parts of the city, not meaning that every last human being or every last adult was there to hear it. That's not what the text is trying to say. But it's saying that certainly an outpouring of people from every section of the community was there, you see, because this really went round like wildfire. And therein we find the key to Paul's approach in preaching the gospel, that he would, wherever possible, start at the synagogue, not just because he was commissioned to go to the Jews first, and then if they didn't hear, after being witnessed to the Gentiles, but by starting there, he could hit two groups at once. Because in every one of these Greek cities, there would have been some full proselytes from the Gentile community, and there would have been God-fearers. So by starting in the synagogue, he has a group which acts as a bridge between the Jewish and the Gentile community that is informed of the gospel and can help to spread that among more widely among the purely Gentile community. And so this was a very good technique. Did we discuss the envy and jealousy? I think we did that last time, didn't we? The Jews, didn't we? So why the Jews got always so envious and jealous when the Gentiles began to really rapidly get interested in this? Yeah, we did discuss that. Yeah, okay. That would have been then on a Monday. Sabbath to Monday. Yeah. Because that would have been the next time the Torah was read. Yeah, that's the literal sense of the Greek. Yeah. That's why, although we have in our literature, I think, even in the past, tended to use this scripture as a support that, you know, he waited a whole week before preaching again, it doesn't really support that point. I mean, it shouldn't be used that way, because the literal sense of the Greek is in the sense of the next day that the Torah would normally be read, which would not be the next Sabbath, because they read it Sabbath, Mondays, and Thursdays. You see? So, quite fast, yes. Okay. Now, the opposition was stirred up by the devout and prominent women who were adherents of the synagogue, and the chief men of the city, because of their influence, raised up a persecution against Paul and Barnabas and expelled them from their region. I know the Old King James says coast, but region is the proper translation. And then again, we find that it starts over again. It happened in Iconium. They went together to a synagogue of the Jews and spoke that a great multitude, both of the Jews and of the Greeks, believed. The Greeks, of course, who were the God-fearers. And then, of course, eventually through them to the purely Greek community. But the unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their minds against the brethren. And eventually, we have this event mentioned in Iconium in verse 4. The multitude of the city was divided, part sided with the Jews and part with the apostles. Now, I have good friends who are Greeks, including one I graduated with, that I still remain in correspondence with on occasion. And I have nothing against Greeks. But they tend to be a very fractional people. They get very hot and excited about issues. This is noted in all the literature, especially in ancient times. In fact, we know the term ostracism to mean what? What does it mean to ostracize somebody? Alan? Set them aside, ignore them, not have anything to do with them. It comes from the Greek word ostraka, which is the plural. It means potsherds. Now you might say, what in the world does excluding somebody from your social contact have to do with potsherds? Because in ancient Greece, in the cities that were democracies, they sometimes would get so hot over political disputes between two major points of view that the only way of restoring peace and harmony to the city was to hold a ballot involving all the citizens, and everybody came into the assembly, the amphitheater, and was given a potsherd. And on that potsherd, he wrote the name of the leader of one of the two factions. And whoever got the most votes, because then the potsherds were collected and counted, whoever got the most votes, he and all the leaders of that faction were exiled. That was the way they restored harmony to the city, because they got so into this that they would literally tear the community apart if they didn't do something. And so this is what was done. And this, of course, gave rise to the term ostracism, which we use. Now, as I said, this is just a typical feature of Greek life. And so we see this happening even over Paul and Barnabas and what they're preaching. The city has become so bitterly divided, you see, and they're yelling and screaming at each other practically, over whether they support this thing and it should be allowed to go on, or they don't support it and it shouldn't be allowed to go on, that they use the typically Greek approach to resolve the conflict. They said, look, these people, whether they're good or bad, they're causing discord in our city of great moment, you know. Let's just get rid of them. You know, this is the answer. This is a typical solution. And so, as I say, that when a violent attempt was made by both the Gentiles and the Jews with their rulers to abuse and stone them because they were the source of the dispute, they left and they fled to Lystra and Derbe, cities of Lycaonia, to the surrounding region. And there they preached the gospel. At Lystra, a certain man without strength in his feet was sitting, a cripple from his mother's womb, who had never walked. The man heard Paul speaking. Paul, observing him intently and seeing that he had the faith to be healed, said with a loud voice, "Stand up straight on your feet," and he leaped and walked. When the people saw what Paul had done, they raised their voices, saying in the Lycaonian language, "The gods have come down to us in the likeness of men." Now, this already tells us something about the region. They speak their own local dialect. They know Greek, but they don't use it among themselves. This is a bit unusual, because in a town like Iconium or Antioch, Pisidia, everybody would use as their common spoken language the Greek. They were thoroughly assimilated to the Greek ways. But here in Lycaonia, the people are not so thoroughly assimilated, and they're not using the Greek among themselves. They use their own language. And they say, "The gods have come down to us in the likeness of men." Now, why did they feel that it was a god who had done this rather than some sorcerer, you know, using spirits or whatever to, or something like that? And why is it they called Barnabas Zeus and Paul Hermes? Because Paul did most of the speaking. What's the reason behind it? Dan?
Well, there was a tradition that Jupiter and Mars would come there
before. Right, Jupiter and Hermes, yeah. Right, Zeus and Hermes. That there was a legend that they had in their community that these same two gods had visited in the past. They had been refused hospitality everywhere in the town, which was a grave breach of etiquette in Greek society, except they received hospitality in a miserable little hut on the edge of town where there was an old couple that lived there. They were very poor, and yet they took them in. And as punishment for the lack of hospitality, they had turned the pre-existing town into a marsh and all the people into frogs. And they had cursed the place and said that we will return to this region again sometime in the future and see if the new inhabitants learn anything from the previous ones. And so this was sort of their local folk tradition, that someday they were going to be tested to see if they had changed from the ways of the previous inhabitants. And suddenly here come two strangers, and they, as soon as they get there practically, one of them does something that, you know, is absolutely incredible, you know. And immediately you can say, oh, the legend has come true. They've come back. So let's not be lacking in showing hospitality. And so they brought the oxen and garlands to the gates where they were going to... Notice there's a temple in the front of their city. You see, what happened in the legend is that the town itself was turned into a marsh. But then on the edge of the marsh, the gods created a temple and made the elderly couple, you know, the priest and priestess of the temple. And that's why the temple, instead of being in the town, was still outside of it. Because they, when they built the new town, they just built it again outside, you know, the area of the temple. They just built it on the other side, you might say, of the marsh. So they brought out the oxen they were going to sacrifice, you know, and so on. And, of course, this produces violent reaction on the part of Barnabas and Paul. But notice how they preach to these people about God. How they begin to preach the gospel. In verse 15, they say, "We also are men with you, with the same nature as you, and preach to you that you should turn from these vain things to the living God, who made heaven, earth, and sea, and all things that are in them, who in bygone generations allowed all nations to walk in their own ways. Nevertheless, he did not leave himself without witness, in that he did good, gave us rain from heaven, and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness." There is no mention to Israel, the deliverance from Egypt, God's mercies to Israel down through the generations, his prophets or priests or anything. Totally different approach than he used in the synagogue in Antioch Pisidia. Because he's dealing with people that are simple country folk that don't have any knowledge of Hebrew scripture. So he can't start there to preach the gospel. If he starts preaching about deliverance from Egypt and God's mercy and sending them priests and prophets, they say, well, what is he talking about? This guy's mad. He's babbling, literally. So he begins at the level that they are at, simple country folk, and telling them, look, I've come to reveal to you the God who, even though you didn't know him enough to worship and honor him, has always provided for you anyway, and giving you rain and plentiful harvest. Okay, so we have a very interesting difference in this area of Lystra and Derbe than the area of Iconium and Antioch. Different kinds of people, different method in preaching the gospel. Okay, let's come down now to chapter 16, where we have Paul's second journey, this time with Silas. And we come to Philippi. Philippi was selected for a specific reason, which is given in verse 12. It says they continued on from there to Philippi, which is the foremost city of that part of Macedonia. In other words, given the limited means they had at their disposal of preaching the gospel, they had to go to the main centers of commerce and allow the word to spread naturally from those centers. Because people from the surrounding region would always be coming into that foremost city for various reasons, hear about the gospel, and be able to take the word back to where they lived. Now it says that it was not only the foremost city of that part of Macedonia, but it was a colony. Now what does that mean? Well, it means something different than what we would use these terms. For instance, if we have a province and we have a colony, which of these two, in our usage, reflects a self-governing group or area where the inhabitants are citizens of the controlling country? Which one is the self-governing area where the people are citizens, you know, with full rights, you know? Tom? Colony is self-governing, the way we use it today? Yeah, the province. Colonies are dependent territories that don't have full equality with the citizens of the mother country. There are some, even if they carry the same passport, there are restrictions placed on them, and even sometimes restrictions on how much internal self-government they have. They don't have complete self-government. A colony is a dependent territory. In Roman periods, it was reverse. This was the dependent area. This was the citizen-inhabited, self-governing body. Now, sometimes cities, individual cities in a province, might have self-government by special grant of the Romans. But a colony was always self-governing, and the citizens were predominantly Romans. Now, you might say that's kind of a backward thing. Well, it's just the word they used, the way they used the term. In other words, they planted deliberately colonies of Romans in certain key areas because that way they'd have an absolutely loyal population in a strategic location. That was the purpose behind it. And Philippi had that unique distinction. I'd like to finish with this one. And one comment about Ephesus, which I'll do very fast. And that is, we know that Paul got into trouble here. He was arrested and thrown into prison. But what happened between the time he was arrested and he was thrown into prison? What happened here at Philippi? He was beat. Which was the normal punishment for the crime. In other words, he was arrested. There was no trial. He was arrested, judged guilty without a trial, punished according to Roman law, which was by beatings with the rods that the officials carried, and thrown into prison. And then, of course, in the morning, the leaders of the city sent some flunky down there to say, okay, now get out of town. And Paul stood up and said, I'm not leaving until the leaders of the city come here and take me out personally. Because as a Roman citizen, they had broken Roman law by punishing him without a trial. This was considered a very grave breach of law. If word of this reached Rome, every one of those leaders would have been out of a job and maybe losing their heads as well. Because if Roman citizenship wasn't honored in a Roman colony of all places, what good was it? You know, this would have created such a public scandal. The thing was, the rulers of Philippi, identifying Paul and Silas as being Jews, assumed they weren't Romans and didn't even bother to ask. Because very few Jews in this period of time were Romans. So they didn't bother to check. They assumed. And therefore, Paul literally had him over a barrel because all he had to do was threaten to tell Rome on them and they would be, you know, maybe losing their lives. So he could be very high-handed with them and get away with it. After that, he never had any more trouble with being received properly in Philippi. Very quickly, Thessalonica. The problem in Thessalonica, the charge that was leveled against them, was that in verse 7 of chapter 17, Jason has harbored these people, and these are all acting contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying there is another king, Jesus. What is the accusation against Barnabas? I mean, Silas and Paul? They're preaching treason. Now, Thessalonica was a self-governing city by grant of the Roman government. If word reached Rome that they were allowing people to freely move about the city preaching treason, they would lose their self-government very quickly. And so you can understand, once this charge was leveled against them, that this troubled the crowd and the rulers of the city when they heard these things, as it says in the next verse. You can understand why it would. And so they got rid of them very fast. In Ephesus, you may recall that when the disturbance was raised by Demetrius, the silversmith, and they were taken into the amphitheater, this huge mob pulled into the amphitheater here, that one of the rulers began to quiet the crowd by reminding them, as it says here in chapter 19, verse 35, the city clerk quieted the crowd and said, "Men of Ephesus, What man is there who doesn't know that the city of the Ephesians is the temple guardian of the great goddess Diana? Then he says in verse 37, you have brought these men here who were neither robbers of temples nor blasphemers of the goddess. If Demetrius and his fellow craftsmen have a case against anyone, the courts are open and there are proconsuls. Let them bring charges against one another. But if you have any other inquiry to make, it shall be determined in the lawful assembly, for we are in danger of being called in question for today's uproar. In other words, if the Romans got the picture that they couldn't control the peace of the city leaders would lose their jobs. It's the same thing. Remember, the bottom line for Rome is you've got to keep the lid on things. You've got to maintain public order. Otherwise, we kick you out of your jobs. That's what he was reminding the crowd. They lose their powers of self-government. And so, therefore, they better quiet down the mob and do things quietly and decently and in order. You see. So, again, you know, they were, in essence, saved because of the superstructure of Roman affairs. I think I already mentioned Gallio's action in Corinth, didn't I? About how he drove away their accusers from the judgment seat. Didn't I mention that last time? But when they were accused in Corinth by the Jews that didn't believe, Gallio said, I won't hear the case. Because Judaism was a legal religion, they were off limits to the Roman courts. And he says, if it's a dispute about your doctrines, that's not Roman jurisdiction. You take care of it. You see, this is something, again, that the superstructure of the Roman government had a lot to do with, you know, either the positive or negative things that happened to Paul and his journeys. Okay, we'll let you go, and we'll see you again the day of the final.